From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 166 with guest Mark Manassi, recorded Wednesday, June 30th, 2010. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Run As Radio. I'm your host, Richard Campbell, flying solo again. I'm going to do a one-on-one today with my friend Mark Manassi. So not a lot of intro today, Mark. I'm just going to drag you in. After all, everybody knows who you are.
Well, I certainly hope so, Richard, although you may be more famous among the Run As crowd, so I guess we'll just see there.
I don't know about that necessarily.
So we haven't done this in a while, and I thought, you know, today, why don't we talk about, because we've gotten a new version of Windows just recently, right? And we just got a new version of Office, because for those of you listening to the archive, we're talking in, what, July, almost July of 2010. And I wrote a piece recently where I sort of beat the Office team up for congratulating themselves on a new version of Office, because you go back and think about this, and it dawned on me that, maybe it's just me, but I mean, I've been using Office since the early days.
Yes.
And I can think of maybe one thing in Word that I didn't have in Word 95. So my argument was, I could be doing my job in Word 95 and really not be missing anything.
Yep, you wouldn't be suffering at all.
Well, you know, one thing I do kind of like is that I'm old, and so for me, I like text-based files. I like stuff I can fix with Notepad. And so I've always kind of wanted Microsoft to adopt something like the old SGML, or nowadays we've got the XSLT stuff. And for those who don't know what I'm talking about, the notion is that you build documents using something that looks a lot like HTML, although it's a lot more flexible and more powerful. And the cool thing about it is that you can build rich documents, you know, with something as simple as a Notepad. So I always thought that was kind of cool. And one thing we have to say for Office 2010, and I guess 2007, is that if you know how to do it, you can actually pull out something that looks a bit like HTML. So that's kind of a positive thing. Honestly, having bitched about not having that feature for years, I haven't spent 5 minutes on it in the last 3 years. But that's a good thing, you know.
I also feel like Microsoft's done a good job of making the package such that you end up buying the whole thing every time. The real claim to fame for Office 2010 is the new version of Outlook.
Okay.
And the main thing that's important on the new version of Outlook is the fact that I can have two Exchange servers.
Two Exchange servers.
So I can actually, you know, I have customers who have Exchange servers that have given me an account in Exchange.
Oh, okay.
And up until now, I've had to IMAP into those servers to get the mail. Now they can both be Exchange accounts.
You know, I know that problem because every now and then, people assume that because I'm an Active Directory guy, I must be an Exchange guy, and I'm not. And so I think, well, I should learn Exchange. And so what I'm going to do is I'll replace my mail server, and I'll set up an Exchange mail server, and I do that. And after I do that, when I've run Exchange server for a while, it makes me want to do that. It makes me want to exchange my server for another kind of email server.
It's the most popular mail server in the world.
The most prevalent virus in human beings is herpes, and that doesn't mean it's a good thing, okay?
Nice.
92% of the human race has some form of herpes inside their bodies, you know, shingles or, you know.
You always have the most happy metaphors.
Well, I'm sorry?
You always have the happiest metaphors. I don't know what that is.
No, wait a minute. Before the Exchange team puts a head out on me, let me clarify. No, Exchange is great stuff, and Exchange does. I mean, look, what's Microsoft's goal? Microsoft's goal is to make just 499 companies happy. You know, there are 499 companies in the Fortune 500 that they care about. Apple can go screw themselves as far as they're concerned. And, well, you knew that's the one I was thinking of.
Right.
And the thing is that makes the most sense. I mean, if Richard and Mark Limited Incorporated were this monster organization, then we want to sell to big companies. It means we write them one check, you know, and we get, you know, they write us a big check, and we just send them a DVD or something like that. It's the way to go. It's a wonderful way to go. And so with that in mind, I mean, Exchange took a long time to get started. The original beta was very late, and Brian, what's his name, sort of made his fame in Windows for being the guy who finally got Exchange out. Exchange 4, it was was it bad? You know, and then what do we have? 5, and then 5.5 was sort of the good one in the sense that I could actually understand it. And then we went to 2000 and so on. But it's so complex that I ran an Exchange 2003 server, and something went wrong with the database. And I'm not a dumb guy about this stuff, and I could never put it back together. I mean, all Norton's horses and all Norton's men couldn't put my information store back together again. So I've been away from it. But, you know, there's a new Exchange, and so I'll probably have to try that again. But I did have that problem because I have 3 email accounts that I use.
Right.
And they were all on my Exchange server. And it just, I kept banging my head against the wall saying, there must be something I'm missing.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I'm obviously doing something wrong.
Right, right. Because there's a big paradigm I'm missing. And I talked to some people, and I actually got a chance to talk to the fellow who was the head of the Exchange team, because he and I were both keynoting a show, and we had a beer afterwards, and I said, do you mind if I ask you an Exchange question? He sort of rolled his eyes. I said, no, I'm going to be nice. And I told him that. He says, yeah. No. He says, I have just one thing to say in response to that. I said, what's that? He says, it's not our fault. It's Outlook's fault. Which I'm willing to believe, because, you know, Outlook has to be the biggest shared delusion in the entire world, because Outlook, we've talked about this before. I believe I ranted about this the last time we were on, but very briefly. So my experience with Outlook is that I have a SMTP/webmail/IMAP/pop server, which runs pretty well. And if I access my email through its web interface, it's just jolly. And I've got Outlook set up to grab my email through HTTP mail, which is a well-understood protocol and such. It's not that the server is doing a bad job. It's that, and so I'll turn on Outlook, and the first thing it does is it says, now synchronizing headers. I think, okay, that's fine. You go do that. I've got 3 accounts. You know, that's jolly. I'll go get me a soda and come back, you know. And I come back, and so I've got the 3 folders, 1 for each account. And when I just click on it, one of those folders for the first time, it says, now synchronizing headers. Please wait. All right, I don't know why we just did that, because it's been 15 seconds since you did it before.
Yeah, how hard could it be?
And then when you get inside that folder, you have to click the inbox folder that's inside the folder that's related to the account. And again, it synchronizes headers. And many times, it'll just sit there and go into a little infinite loop. And at that point, Outlook, this is Outlook 27, 2007, will just kind of get this white Outlook. Have you ever seen this?
Yes, the white screen of death.
Actually, there's a phrase for that. I discovered that inside Microsoft, there's a phrase for that. That's called arrow frost.
Arrow frost. Oh, yeah.
Arrow frost is that if there's a window, it's a top-level window that is not responding to the user, then the feedback you get, in addition to not responding, which is sitting in the title, is it frosts over.
Right.
And I'm actually told that the Outlook team wanted to find out how to turn it off because it was really causing a lot of users to complain. But anyway, so I don't understand why they can't multi-thread the interface. I mean, certainly there's lots of threads going on. But again, if I've got those 3 accounts, if it's playing with itself trying to find the first one,
right,
I should be able to go click that other folder and say, go get the second one at the same time. So some sort of multi-threading on the user interface. And I'm very sad to say that Outlook 2010 works exactly the same way.
Yeah.
Which is kind of sad. You know?
Well, and this was a line actually from .NET Rocks where we were talking to Jeff Richter, a guy who's deeply into the threading space. And he got me to fire up Task Manager and add the threads column to my Task Manager. He says, now sort by thread. And the one right at the top was Outlook. That had 68 threads going, and I'm like, wow, 68 threads, and apparently none of them are for me.
Yes, it seems that your user interface is very specifically single-threaded, and Richter's a smart guy. If you had him on the show, then don't put his talk next to mine, because he knows what he's talking about. He has access content. So I got two other bitches about Outlook, and then, you know, we'll move along. The first one is, and you're not going to be aware of this because you use an Exchange server.
Yes.
But, you know, it's possible in an Outlook message to right-click it and set a flag. So you get a little, like, red flag or white flag or something like that. You know, whether something's a priority or not, right?
Yep.
Okay. That stopped being possible in Outlook 2003 if you don't have an Exchange server.
You sort of took that away.
So in Outlook 97, the feature arrives. In 2000, we love the feature. And then in 2003, it stops working. I'm like, what's going on? And then when I put the Exchange server on, bang, it comes back. And I talked to the Outlook people. I finally found someone who would talk to me. And they said, yeah, we turned that off for non-Exchange people. I said, why? They said, well, we felt it was a value added for Exchange customers.
Nice.
So I paid to upgrade to get fewer features. And the other one that I truly, truly miss is that, just for a moment, let's talk about why is Exchange Server the most popular Exchange server? What, excuse me, the most popular email server. What does it do that your basic generic SMTP Popmail doesn't do?
Well, yeah, the public folders, the integration with Active public Directory.
Folders? I mean, I don't know a lot of people that use public folders.
Yeah, and the funny part, of course, is that the Exchange team has always tried to get you to not use them, too.
But that's that was the plan. Doesn't Exchange 2010 not have public folders, that they were going to finally die?
It was supposed to, but they put them back in because so many people screamed.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I was going to say the number one thing that Exchange does that originally drew people to it is shared calendars.
Right.
You know? And back in, I want to say, either Outlook 97 or Outlook 2000, we had this thing called shared Outlook folders, which was totally groovy. I'm not a big shop. I've got a handful of people working with me. And so I really just need my assistant to be able to share my my calendar. And that was a great feature. Worked in 2000, and I think they took it out in 2003. So basically what they're saying is, it's silly for me to put in all this infrastructure in order to share a calendar. So It would be nice if we could restore the features of Outlook 2000 to, say, Outlook 2013 or something like that. Call me crazy. So anyway, here's another one. And you'll understand this because you're a presenter guy like me. So when we're putting PowerPoints together, Have you ever had a chunk of a PowerPoint? Like, for example, I have 6 slides about the new WinRM protocol. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, there's a protocol called RPC, Remote Procedure Call Service. And what RPC does is it's kind of the way that one program makes a telephone call to another program over the network. So, for example, using Outlook in Exchange, when Outlook, which is an application sitting on your computer, wants to ask Exchange, which is an application sitting on a server far, far away, please get the mail, then they need some protocol so that Outlook can tap Exchange on the shoulder, say, I want some data, this is how I want the data, etc. That's RPC, Remote Procedure Call. It has been around since 1985 when Microsoft first built their first networking software, which is the IBM PC LAN support program, which arrived on the 15th of April, 1985. And in those days, we didn't have an internet. I mean, Canada did. I mean, Canada had data pack and that sort of thing. I honestly don't know how widely used it was by Canadian businesses. But we had nothing like that in the United States. And so the idea of having to add security to RPC, I mean, in those days, networks were all about private organizations, and most networks didn't extend outside of the building. And so when we said security, it was usually before the word blanket, you know. And so RPC right out of the ground didn't have a lot of security. Of course, that internet thingy comes along and changes the world. And the problem is that RPC needs security, so Microsoft tries to bolt it on after the fact. And I'm not beating Microsoft up here. I mean, this is just, they were dealing with the realities of the day in the mid-80s. RPC was a great protocol for what it needed to do. Unfortunately, if you bolt security on it after the fact, as they tried to do in XP Service Pack 2 back in 2004, then you break a whole lot of stuff. And so, and every time there's an RPC failure, I am told that Microsoft has to get something like 15 people in the same room to fix it, and 3 of them are retired.
Nice.
And so it's one of those days where, clearly the Microsoft guys are saying, it's one of those cases where Microsoft is a victim of their own success. And they'd like to get rid of this stuff, but they really just can't do it. So what they're doing is they're building another protocol that replaces it. It's this web service-y kind of thing called WinRM. In any case, WinRM is something that everyone should know about, and if you can read things about it, or if you're at one of my talks, I'll tell you a bit about it, or for all I know, you guys at RunAs do have a show on it. In any case, so I've got about 6 or 7 slides that don't need to change, and they're in a number of courses about WinRM. And if I fix one, or if I enhance one, I've got to go find the friggin' things.
Right.
And I've got to put, Now, that in the web world, because you're a web server guru guy, we've had a thing called server-side includes for quite a long time, where, for example, if you hit one of my newsletters, then where it says, this is where Mark's going to be, well, if you're looking at a newsletter from 5 years ago, you're going to see where Mark's going to be next week. And why? Because those newsletters have a little server-side include where the HTML says, go grab this file and slot it on in here. I don't understand why PowerPoint doesn't do that. I mean, are you with me on this?
You're looking for an inheritance model for PowerPoint.
I'm just looking for I suppose. I mean, I don't know how many levels I'd have to worry about, right?
Right.
But I should be able to plunk in. And for example, there's a member of the office team that's been doing this for over a decade, Excel, right? If I need a cell in an Excel spreadsheet, that is the result of something from one or more cells in another spreadsheet, it's the easiest thing in the world. Why PowerPoint doesn't do that is utterly beyond me.
What's amusing to me about this whole thought is, you know, you led off this conversation with, you know, there haven't been any really unique features in Office since 95. And here's a really great feature that folks who do a lot of presentations would really, really like, and they haven't done that one.
I think it's driven by the same thing that drives a lot of things Microsoft does. If it's an area where they don't have competition, they just don't feel the need for innovation. I mean, I don't know if you were around during the 90s when we started hearing about Active Directory, you know, NT5. I got my first, you know, briefing on it in 1996. And it was pretty clear that for a first shot, Active Directory in Windows 2000 was a pretty good first shot. I mean, not a bad 1.0 at all. Had some pretty major big holes, like you couldn't rearrange forests and domains. But every Microsoft person you talk to would say, well, of course, we got to fix that. Don't worry about it. It's not going to be in product one. That was the way of saying Windows 2000 or NT5. But it's coming soon. It's 10 years. You know, last February 17th was the 10-year anniversary of Active Directory. And it is still every bit as much trouble to uproot and move people from one domain to another as it was in 2000.
Hmm.
And why? Well, you know, when they were talking to us in 1996, 1997, Novell was the big dog, and they had to take down the big dog. By the time 2001, 2002 comes around, there's nobody there. I mean, it's just Novell's essentially left the room. And I think that's the same thing. Is that, yes, I understand that Adobe's got, was it Prezi? And there's something in the Apple suite that's a PowerPoint-y kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's really nothing challenging PowerPoint's dominance. So what we need is, I've always thought that if I were independently wealthy, I would just fund small companies to create stuff to compete with Microsoft just to keep them on their toes.
Just to make stuff better.
Exactly, exactly, you know. And I would either end up with products so great that I'd be insanely rich, or I would just be making the world a better place by nudging Microsoft to keep making things better.
It's very funny.
You're a PowerPoint guy. What would you like to see in PowerPoint?
Oh, no, you described the feature I want the most, right? Which is, yeah, there are nuggets of slides. Heck, just keeping the current set of bio slides from one deck to another.
That's right.
But I realize I have PowerPoint slide decks for a given talk scattered all over the place because you end up using everybody else's templates, right? TechEd's got their own template. Connections has got their own template. You have all these different templates, and so you constantly are adapting to that. So, but invariably, you inherit a deck from something. You know, if I'm deriving, I do a lot of load testing talks. So I have a lot of load testing decks, and any new talk I'm building, I built a brand new one for TechEd on 2010. I had to go and pick what deck am I going to inherit from here and go from there.
How was that? I've only hacked around I've only recently installed Office just long enough to decide that I don't want it and then, you know, took it off. But I didn't play with the PowerPoint 2010 too terribly much. The big thing I saw was the new transitions.
Yeah, and I'm not a big transition guy anyway. I'll give the PowerPoint 2010 guys also really have gotten 16:9 nailed.
Yeah, that's insane. I talked at MMS, Microsoft Management Summit, which is about their System Center stuff. And I was fortunate enough to have a great crowd, and yay, I was number one for the first time. And I did a talk on IPv6, and I did a talk on some internal Kerberos stuff. And they handed me their template. And, of course, you have to convert things to Microsoft template. And the thing is, we know from looking at the way people read that they find reading a portrait page
right. A
heck of a lot easier than a landscape page.
Yes, and 16:9 is very, very wide.
I mean, it's nice if we're going to do movies. You know, I mean, if I want the HD version of House, then okay, that's going to be 16:9 or something. Not exactly 16:9, but
right. Whatever
anamorphic is. And why would we want to put text that way? I don't get that. I don't get that at all.
Well, I'm beginning to believe maybe the bigger problem with PowerPoint is that it exists at all. Because as soon as there's this basic dysfunction you get into where if there's words on the screen, you can't have words coming out of your mouth at the same time. They conflict with each other. I'm tending more towards images on the screen, words coming out of my mouth. Because the alternative is words on the screen and I do interpretive dance. And nobody needs to see that.
Tell me what you're... Okay, for me, my feeling is that one of the things I don't like about presentations nowadays is that there's been this thing that's been happening for the last 4 or 5 years where a Microsoft guy, it's almost always a Microsoft presenter, but many other people are adopting this, is they'll stand up and they'll say, hi, this is my one slide on my PowerPoint. because PowerPoints are so boring, and I'm just going to demonstrate stuff for the next 75 minutes.
Right.
And when that happens, you walk away saying, gosh, darn it, that person, not the actual word used, people, you know, this guy was really smart, and there was all kinds of stuff that I couldn't possibly repeat.
Right.
So I walk away, and it's like, you know, when I was a kid, there was a joke that everybody loves Chinese food, right? And the joke was, an hour later, you're hungry again.
Yep.
In these presentations, an hour later, you're dumb again because you haven't learned anything at all. So for me, maybe I'm just being a contrarian, which would be an odd position for me, of course. But I like big, thick PowerPoints. None of this 20 words on a slide thing. I mean, I almost want to have book text up there. And the reason is, I want to be able to talk, and I'll tell you a story. And some of the words that I use are the same words that are on the PowerPoint, but not exactly. And the big thing is, I think that if you spent $2,000 to go to TechEd, or you spent $1,000 to go to one of my two-day classes, you don't need to play a stenographer. I mean, I want people to go back from my classes, my talks, whatever, with stuff that is almost a textbook. It's stuff that they don't have to make too many notes.
Right. Well, so you're looking at slides as collateral.
Okay.
Right? The main value of the slides is not at the presentation, but after.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And not everybody seems to agree with that, and I don't understand why. Because if you know, nowadays, anything that is, as you know this, the phrase for what you're doing when you're up on stage talking, what I'm doing when I'm up on stage talking, is called ILT, instructor-led training.
Right.
And for our listeners, the reason that's so important is that we're just wired for it. I mean, think about it. What on earth would you spend $1,000 to come to a hotel to hear me talk for a couple of days about Windows 7 when you could just buy my audio recording when I get it done, which will be, what, I don't know, $150, $200, something like that. Or maybe buy a book in Windows 7 that I've written. I'm not going to, but I mean, if I were. But the point is, those are all great ways of learning. But we're wired for storytelling, you know, we're wired for rhyming, we're wired for particular meters when people are speaking. That's the microcode to get into people's brains. And so I think if we're going to do it, I mean, at this point, because there's so much distance learning, there's so many webinars you can watch, there's, again, the books and the yep. audios or whatever. Instructor-led in-person training is essentially the Chateaubriand of education.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once upon a time, it was all there was. But now we've got the McDonald's, you know, and we've got the, you know, the Burger Kings and the Sizzlers and whatever. Those are the different kinds of learning. And my perspective is, if you're actually going to charge people for Chateaubriand, you got to give it to them.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it is, don't make it hard for them to learn.
Well, I think, you know, that now the other side of taking notes, and I'm happy that we're talking presentations in general, because I think anybody listening to this is someone who's trying to find ways that is effective to learning. So this is not a topic I necessarily planned for us to do, but I'm excited about it because it's a big deal for me. The real reason you take notes is to cement things in your mind.
Right.
So giving them on the slides is not necessarily serving that either.
Well, here's what I do when I'm speaking. If you're in a class with me at the end of the first day, I say, let me tell you something about your memory. You have a two-level memory structure, short-term memory, long-term memory. Short-term memory is only good for 18 hours maximum, and that's only if you have the maximum 700 grams of glycogen in your liver that human livers can hold. So a starchy breakfast is a good way to start. But 18 hours from now, you'll forget what I'm saying. And my question will be, for example, my Windows 7 class or my Server 2008 R2 class is, okay, today is Tuesday. We'll be done on Wednesday. How many of you are going to roll out Windows 7 on Thursday? Well, no hands go up.
Right.
And I'll say the problem is, you go home and there's other crises that will, there'll be fires and they'll push stuff out of your short-term memory. And so all you're going to remember is that one day you used to know something. And so I go back and I say, okay, look at the slides, and you're going to find things fall in one of three categories. Either, you know, stuff I don't care about, stuff that might be nice to know, and there's stuff I need to know. If they fall in the last two categories, make some notes right now, because that PowerPoint's all you're going to have. I'm not going to be there, and that should help. And you're going to have to add things, because I can't know what your brain needs.
Right.
And that's what really cements it. So I think it's a combination of not making them scribble. I mean, when I'm talking about some long command line command or some registry entry, people will kill me if they want me to write them down, and with good reason. So I agree with you. Simply having the slides is not enough. It's that starting point that allows you to do the tertiary reinforcement, because you saw and heard it, and now you're going to reread it, and you're going to add the notes to make it your own.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, definitely ownership of the knowledge. This all gets back to, how did people necessarily learn? Different folks learn different ways. I find myself a very good reader of material. that I learn most effectively when I read the material. It goes in that way. And I'm betting you probably do too, because in the end, our business, more than anything these days, has been about taking that and putting it up in different forms so that other people can learn it.
I don't think so. I think you're smarter than I am, Richard, because you do more programming than I do. I was a programmer decades ago, and I learned enough C++ and Win32 to write some utilities a couple of summers ago, so that was a good thing for me. But honestly, I think the only reason that I'm successful at all about teaching things is that I'm just not that smart. It takes me a long time. No, seriously. It's like the old joke. I wrote this letter slowly because I know you don't read too quickly, right?
Right.
And for me, I think there's a, because I've been making a living teaching for 26 years. Mm-hmm. And a couple things that I've found is that one is that when I come up against something new, it seems like you get these intellectual brick walls where I'm reading the stupid document, and even there's a command I'm supposed to type to try something out, and it doesn't work. So there's something I'm missing.
Yeah.
And invariably, it's because someone did a bad job with the documentation. And it feels like this wall, it's 100 miles high. That would be 162 kilometers for Canadians.
Right.
And so, but the funny thing is, once you get the key, it all falls apart. And there's this weird cognitive dissonance that you do where you go back and say, you know what? It couldn't have been as hard as I remember it.
Right.
But then I'd be really dumb.
Well, that's that really evil thing that tech people do where they say, don't worry, this is easy.
And right, like, exactly.
It wasn't easy. You now understand it, so you're undermining the value of the knowledge you actually have.
But they're not doing it for an evil reason.
No.
They're doing it because they've fooled themselves.
Yes.
So one of the most important things that I would say to anyone who's writing stuff is keep notes about where the big walls were. And you're going to be looking at them a year and a half later and say, I know, this is as easy as breathing. Trust me. There was a moment that it was hard for you.
Yeah.
And if you can make it easy for other people, they're going to just love you, you know?
Yeah, you're going to get there.
So, I mean, I have to chip away and chip away at things. And so, of course, the pitfall there is that sometimes, and I've done it, and many of my co-authors have done it, and so I've trained myself not to do it years and years ago, but you want to take the reader along on your journey of discovery. And the reader doesn't care about that. The reader wants the short distance.
Right.
The short distance to the point. And along those lines, by the way, if anybody's listening and wants to know more about this stuff, I was telling Richard before we get started that I did a talk with Mark Rusinovich about how to do technical talks without tucking people in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of fun. It was 75 minutes. We did it in New Orleans. And if you were smart enough to stay out of New Orleans in June, I love New Orleans, but my God, is it hot there.
Oh, man.
I'm told that you can go to the Microsoft TechEd site, and I'm told that all of the talks can be seen right there.
Yeah, TechEd Online.
Is that what it is? It's techedonline.com?
Mm-hmm. Microsoft. If you just go to microsoft.com/TechEd, you can go to the North American site, but it'll lead you to the TechEd Online site, which is where all of the talks are.
And I'm not suggesting I have all the answers. I mean, I don't even have most of them. But there's a couple things I've found out the hard way. And so anybody who's thinking about doing a presentation, that's something to think about. But I like what you're saying. I think what you were saying about not caring about the transitions is that ultimately I think a presentation is about the presenter and the way the presenter delivers the topic. And, the PowerPoint's just lanyard.
Right. Well, and especially the tech ed deck, like when you get that tech ed master deck, when you're going to start building your slides, you could see that whoever built this, it's really designed to be handed to a very technical Microsoft employee who doesn't know much about doing presentations. Does it really help anyone to have a slide that says demo?
Actually, I have a more sinister explanation for
that.
I thought that last year's tech ed, and this is the 2009 North American Tech Ed template, was the worst template I'd ever seen in my life. The learning lives here thing, where there was no room left on the slide to actually put anything. But this year was even worse.
Wow.
New Orleans was.
You thought they'd hit the bottom and you were wrong.
They had the drilling machines. And you know what it boils down to? As an author, I can tell this story, and you will know this also, I'm certain, because you're an author as well. And what happens is you write a book, and everything is just groovy until the production people get to it.
Right.
The production people are these soulless trolls whose job it is to leech the joy out of writing a book. These are people whose job in life is to make it much more. I'll give you an example. For years, I made a lot of money on a book called The Complete PC Upgrade and Maintenance Guide.
Mm-hmm,
it was a how to fix your PC kind of book. And it was a lot of fun to write. It was a lot of fun to update every year and stuff like that. I just ran out of time, and so I haven't done it in a while, and I probably never will again. It's a shame. And I paid a woman $50,000 over the course of a year to draw excellent, fantastically good diagrams of PCs and what they look like when they're apart and stuff like that, because I believe that a good diagram can be better than a good photograph, because the good diagram lets me take out the extraneous details.
Right.
Anyway, so Maeve Cregan, who did this wonderful work, my publisher basically threw those all away and had someone else redraw them with this kind of hep and sexy look where there's no right angles on the computer and they've got little wavy things that come off of them. And
made them stylish.
Stylish. I specifically flew out to California with the intent of killing someone. I thought to myself, this is something I've got to do for the art. I'm sorry.
Unbelievable.
Anyway, so production people work a job and they move to another job and they maintain a portfolio of all the junk, all the work they've done.
Nice.
And so they're talking to design people that couldn't give a hoot about computers or, you know, fixing PCs or whatever, because these people could probably, I don't know, maybe they're trying to become people who do food ads or something like that. And so they have no interest in the content. They just want it to be pretty.
Well, I think the other side of that is I don't envy anybody trying to come up with a slide template for tech ed when there's been 20 of them.
Exactly. You know? And shouldn't the goal be maximum readability?
Right.
It doesn't have to be cute, for God's sake.
Well, and it doesn't. And does it have to be unique? If we happen to hit on the perfect template for TechKid, can't we just keep it?
It is a thought.
Well, now I think we've come off full circle here, my friend, because we're back at the issue of Office 2010, which is, hey, I think you hit the perfect version of Office about 15 years ago.
Yes, just about. Except for Outlook. Outlook needs to be blown up and rebuilt, but yes, I have to agree there.
The only thing I would say in favor of Outlook is all of the alternatives appear worse. Why is it impossible to build an email client that doesn't suck?
You know, it's a great question. I wrote a piece about this recently, and I said, and I know that someone's going to say the fact that I'm not using an Exchange server is going to be touted as being the source of my problems, and it's wrong because I've used Exchange servers with Outlook as well. But the killer for me was there are two main client devices that I use to get my email. One is my PC running Outlook. The other one is my iPhone.
Right.
And the iPhone can pull the data off the server like about, five times faster than Outlook can.
Which is interesting because it's just a little phone, you know. It hasn't got that much horsepower. It's all that muscle in that machine.
There you go. That's right.
Yeah, what's going on?
So you're saying my PC is muscle-bound.
Yeah, your PC is muscle-bound compared to your iPhone anyway.
Well, I don't know how much more time we have. Why don't we beat up on Windows for a bit?
I think we're done with this show, but I'm not opposed to doing another one if you're so inclined.
Okay.
All right? Because this has turned into a presentation and office discussion, which I'm not unhappy with. But let's call this a show and make another one.
That sounds fine.
Thanks very much for coming on, Mark.
Hey, always good to be on. You take care, man.
And I'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.